Good morning, everyone. I think we might make a start. We've got a very heavy program. My name's David Bailey. I'm a member of Greens List, and my colleagues at the table here are also on Greens List. Our first speaker will be Doug Sharifs. And the topic we're asking ourselves is, what is the future of franchising? And I was reminded last night when I went to a retired partner's function in my old firm that I cut my teeth on franchising as a very young lawyer, and I was asking the question then, what is the future of franchising? So nothing really changes. Anyway, Doug comes to us with a very illustrious background. He, before he came to the bar, he was a commercial solicitor with Minter Ellison, specialising in competition and consumer law. He's a qualified economist, company director, and has worked in senior roles for the ACCC. He's got a diverse commercial practice and accepts briefs to appear and advise in all jurisdictions for clients of all sizes, he tells me, and he regularly appears in mediations, practice court applications, hearings and appeals. In relation to franchising, Doug has dealt with matters such as alleged misconduct in franchising arrangements, anti-competitive conduct, breaches of consumer trader regulations and product safety, alleged misleading conduct, and alleged breaches of statutory warranties. And he's acted in a wide range of industries. I can pick some of this up from his CV on Greens List site. And I think in terms of specific franchising matters, he's designed and advised on commercial arrangements for franchisors, termination strategies, which I guess we all get involved in at times, competition law compliance strategies, and dispute resolution provisions to comply with the franchising code and other provisions. So can we welcome Doug? I think we're looking forward to what he has to say. Doug Sharifs.
Thank you. Thank you, David. I really should do something about a shorter introduction, I guess, for those things, shouldn't I, for the sake of everybody in the audience. Thanks, everybody, for coming in. I have to come from out at the foot of Mount Dandenong, so I appreciate the time that people spend on public transport or whatever coming to those occasions, so thank you. In terms of what is the future of franchising, I guess one of the things that I hope you'll take from this, and it'll be a segue to Mark's presentation, is that I think the proposed changes are likely really to lead to quite a bit more disputation, and I guess that from the perspective of perhaps legal practitioners, you might say that the future of franchising is rosy, insofar as there'll be plenty, I reckon, for people to do. Okay, thank you. Just what I'll try and cover, and obviously you've got the paper, so I probably won't be able to get through all of this, but I'll try and race through a fair bit of it. Just a little bit of context, a few of the principles, a little bit about the exposure bill and some particular clauses there. I'll just pose the question, does this really result in any rebalancing of power? I guess if you look at some of the context, there was a suggestion that maybe there was an opportunity to rebalance some of the power between franchisors and franchisees. Query that. I'll suggest to you that the inevitable result is going to be greater ACCC activism and that more disputes are likely to happen, and just a couple of cases which I'll touch on, in particular one that was a case from earlier this year which has got some interesting principles. Okay, so by way of context, we go back to the 2008 amendments, which was the Matthews Review, and the emphasis there was really about disclosure. And that's interesting because a lot of the emphasis of the current Wayne Review, or the immediately previous Wayne Review on which these amendments are based, was an emphasis on disclosure, as well as arguably an emphasis on good faith. The 2010 amendments, there was a joint parliamentary committee, and then out of that arose this commitment to what became the Wayne Review last in 2013. And the purpose of that was really to look at the earlier amendments, at the efficacy of those, and the terms of reference really included central topics of examining the element of good faith in franchising, end-of-term rights of franchisees, and interaction between the Code and the Competition and Consumer Act. In terms of the Harper Review, or the, what do they call it, I think the Root and Branch Review of Competition Law, submissions for that are due by the 17th of November. The final report is scheduled to be in March 2015, so it'll actually occur after the intended implementation of the exposure bill of the franchising code amendments. I spoke to someone at Treasury the other day, and my response was that the government's committed to the franchising code amendments and that they consider the implications from the Harper review to just be potentially too far reaching. So if there's any interaction, that'll have to be dealt with at a separate time in future if there's going to be any need to align any amendments between the two. Okay, so the principles are contained in the exposure draft, which was circulated in April 2014, and it essentially reflects the recommendations from the Wayne Review. There was 18 recommendations made, and then there's been some further consultation which has taken place between industry and between government and the department. I can see there's at least one person from the franchising, or a member of the Franchising Council of Australia here, so you'll spare me the difficult questions, but my understanding is that there's been further consultation, including with the FCA and various other sort of peak representative groups on both sides of the franchising relationship. One of the key objectives was to ensure good faith in dealings between the parties, and that's going to be expanded to all aspects of the relationship. Now, the obvious consequence, and something I'll talk a little bit more about further on, is that there's going to be feedback into more mediation, I believe. And so I really encourage you to listen to some of the things that Mark's got to say about that, in particular to mediation strategy, because I think what will happen is you get different types of disputes. They won't just be your typical sort of, the franchisee's getting done over by the franchisor and wants to terminate and get out and so on and so forth. You'll find that there'll be mediation in relation to negotiations about franchises and things like that, for example. So it'll be useful, I think, to try and exercise your mind about how you might approach those mediations differently in different circumstances. Further principle was to enhance enforcement, and so there's clauses where there's going to be the introduction of pecuniary penalties. Improved disclosure was another objective, and part of that was to actually include this idea of rationalising the disclosure requirements. Now, whether or not that's actually going to happen in practice, I think will be an interesting thing, because rather than there actually now being the two different types of disclosure document, the short form and the long form in the code, there's now going to be the new risk statement requirement as well as a disclosure requirement, and I suspect that that may very well introduce uncertainty rather than actually making things easier. There's going to be greater scrutiny of marketing funds. It's a bit of a bane of the franchisee, I guess, if you look sort of fairly broadly across the industry, that they're often complaining that they don't think they get bang for their buck in terms of contributions for marketing funds. And there's also the idea that there's not very good transparency and separation of accounting around marketing funds as distinct from the general activities of franchisors in some situations. The expected commencement of the provisions is going to be from the 1st of January next year. Now, in the same chat I had with someone up in Canberra, they assured me that the policy objectives are really going to stay the same. So it's unlikely, in my understanding, that there's going to be really radical departures from the exposure draft. So if you're wanting to sort of do a bit of work before next January, I think it's probably a pretty good place to start. However, government is still considering the final form of the code document. But the principles, if you look at the exposure draft, are probably going to remain reasonably similar, so I think it's really well worth having a look at the exposure draft. How it will actually work as a matter of practice, I think there's a little bit of sort of work to keep going on there. As I said, still on track for 1st of January next year. It's anticipated that the changes will go to the Executive Committee in about October, so I don't know whether I guess they could be there now. And if necessary, there's going to be transitional arrangements. Although, on my understanding, there will only be one document. And I guess that's really important, because if you think about it, there's going to be obligations which will be different from the 1st of January 2015, and there'll be many franchise relationships which span both sides of that. And so the obvious question is, how do you trigger these new provisions and the application of the new provisions? My sense is that post-implementation, the critical thing is going to actually be whether there's renewals and variations and those types of situations where you'll be able to bring yourself within the technical application of the code. But also, if you think about these new provisions in relation to good faith, there'll be obvious triggers for mediation and disputes arising in that relationship where people are simply saying, well, actually, look, you know, I'm I've got a right within the new provisions, or I haven't got a right within the new provisions. So there'll be all sorts of disputes there potentially. As far as I understand it, the pecuniary penalty provisions are a done deal. There's a separate bill which has been through the Senate in September, and the code's simply going to identify the applicable provisions and the penalties and the existing powers of the ACCC to leverage those penalty provisions will be applied from the Competition and Consumer Act, and also their existing infringement notices powers are going to be leveraged to the code provisions. As I understand it, just in terms of a principle, I guess, in terms of that application question, the policy position is, as soon as practicable, all of the provisions in the amended code will apply to franchise relationships. I guess the consequence, or the obvious corollary of that, is that there'll also probably be a need for grandfather provisions of some description. Okay, so just a couple of clauses that you might want to have a look at. The application question I don't propose to really dwell on again. Simply, if you have a look at clause 3, it actually talks about the code applying to a franchise agreement entered into on or after 1 January or renewed on or after 1 January. People who are familiar with the code will know that there's concepts of renewal and there's also concepts of extension of the scope of franchises and things like that. Now, it's not obvious from the current drafting how that's all going to be addressed, but in my suggestion, there'll have to be some way of actually completing the drafting so it's comprehensive in that regard. And I think the further thing is, as I've mentioned, there'll be a need for a grandfather clause. And so I'd anticipate that it, sort of 3 years after the 1st of January or something like that, it'll just be deemed that this code applies to relationships. So I guess as people perhaps practicing for franchisors, you know, there'll be a strategic decision there and a strategic discussion with your client about how you actually manage their franchise terms so that you try and get these to all converge around a certain point in time. Okay, clause number 7, which is in relation to good faith. The obligation, as is presently stated, is to act towards another party with good faith in respect of any matter arising under or in relation to the agreement and this code. So, I expect the phone will ring a bit after the 1st of January, and I reckon your phones will ring a bit too if you've got franchisors or franchisees as clients. The disclosure requirements are going to be in clause 9, and the issue there, I think, is that whilst there is proposed to be further disclosure, there's also some clarity about the need to not update disclosure, and the case I'll talk about is SPA licensing, where there was a question about actually what are the requirements around the currency of disclosure documents. So there's some clarification given around that. It's also important to note that there are going to be pecuniary penalty provisions. So there's going to be argy-bargy around this, and I think there's a very real possibility that where there's non-compliances, that the ACCC will probably be looking to act in this area in order to ensure that there is compliance with what's regarded as a new position. The information statement, which is part of the disclosure regime, there's an annex or a proposed annex to the exposure draft which sets out what the information statement requirements are. Now, I think this, maybe it's just my perverse sense of humour, it's a little bit early, but it's proposed that they actually set out the font size, and it's proposed that it not be any more than 2 pages, but if you actually look at the one in the annex, it's 4. So it's, I don't know quite how that one's going to work, but we're from the government, we're here to help. Okay, I think really the issue there is that this information statement is going to be sort of, it's really just another form of disclosure. It's another form of representation made to people. Now, you cannot contract out of the requirements for misleading and deceptive conduct, those provisions in the ACL. And there's, in my mind, there's little doubt that this will just be a fertile ground for further disputes. Instead of having a short form and long form disclosure document which essentially covered the same material, I think really what this is doing is introducing further scope for disputation rather than actually clarifying things. So you can look forward to that. Clause 19, end of term arrangements. This was another issue which has been a big issue, and it's also a very you know, important and prominent issue in the franchising relationship, what actually happens at the end of terms, end of franchise terms, and there's new provisions there which are pecuniary penalty provisions. So I encourage you to just sort of have a bit of a think about that. And again, if you're acting for franchisors, just try and get, you know, if you can, get clients to get their house in order before the end of the term of franchises so that they can comply with these provisions, because it'd be an awful shame if they inadvertently end up breaching these pecuniary penalty provisions. Clause 22, the jurisdiction. Now, I reckon this is a ridiculous one, but it looks like the requirement is going to be that the party brings an action or proceedings in a state or territory in which the franchise business is based. Now, I guess you can go back to the definition of the franchise business, and there might be some argy-bargy about that, but it seems to me that there's, you know, this is an example of really blatant pandering to sort of the small business lobby, where, you know, you've got big national companies, and the whole idea that they should have to sort of go and litigate, I think, in a particular jurisdiction, because that's just where they have a branch, if you like, or a franchise branch, I think that's a bit onerous. Anyway, it looks like that's the way it's going to be. I might just mention, in respect to the disclosure provisions as well, it's going to be the case that there'll be greater opportunities for electronic disclosure. Now, I'm not aware of any discussion that I've seen about the interaction between the provisions in relation to disclosure and electronic disclosure and the Electronic Transactions Act of 1999, which is a Commonwealth Act. So I just encourage you to sort of think that through when you're doing your homework about disclosure as well. Okay. This is a really controversial one, and I think that this will be an area where there's a bit of activity. With respect to the effect of restraint provisions, the essence of this is intended to be that where a franchisor doesn't renew an application, that there will be no restraint, or at least there will be limited opportunities for them to impose restraint provisions. And the idea, I think, really comes from the whole idea that, if you think about it, the franchisee in a situation where they could perhaps take a lease, or they could continue to run a bread shop, perhaps an unbranded bread shop, or some hot bread shop, or something like that, in a situation where the franchisor doesn't give them the opportunity to continue in the franchise relationship, it's really doing them out of a living if you say, well, you can't continue to practice your trade, if you like, in that site. So the question will be for franchisors to just strategically think about how they treat sites, I guess, going forward. I think that it's likely that there'll be, you'll sort of almost get multiple level sites and multiple, possibly multiple term franchises, where you've got a real Rolls-Royce site. They want to make sure that that's all tied up and locked down for years and years and years. But in light of these no restraint provisions, I think you'll probably find that there's a sort of a, if you like, the country cousin franchises where, you know, there's not the same application of effort there, and where the renewals perhaps, you know, come and go, or you'll get franchises for just one term and then it becomes a separate business or whatever. I think it'll be interesting to see how this actually affects the industry. Perhaps that's speaking as an economist, really, more than a lawyer. But the bottom line will be that franchisors will have to think very, very carefully, I think, going forward about when they will and will not renew those franchise arrangements, because they're not going to be able to restrain people in situations where they don't offer to renew them. Clause 26, with respect to consent to transfers, that's another one which is a bane of many people's existence. So just have a look at that. There's some proposed changes there. The essence of it will really be that you've still got that reasonableness test. So I'm not so sure that there's going to be a lot that will change there. Okay, termination. Now, this is where there's a few things that might change. So you might want to have a bit of a look at that. The real essence is that there's civil penalty provisions which are going to apply for unlawful termination. So you really need to be mindful of the circumstances in which franchisors do terminate franchisees. Having said that, if you look at large franchisors, the pecuniary penalties are intended to be about $50,000. It's neither here nor there. If you compare that to, say, cartel provisions, where you can actually get maximum penalties which relate to the commercial benefit of an anti-competitive transaction, the incentives are very, very different. There will be a lot of franchisors who probably won't really miss a beat at the $50,000. The reputation issue is going to be the thing which will really discipline the market. And I think that's really the thing that the pecuniary penalty idea introduces into the franchising relationship. Most franchisors, in my experience, really pride themselves on acting with good faith and on their brand. That's their intellectual property. And so for them to be perceived as having contravened a pecuniary penalty provision, that will be the thing that disciplines the market. It'll have nothing to do with the $50,000. Okay, so even though they're pretty soft, I suppose, in practice, the penalties, I think, are likely to have a significant effect. Have a look at Division 6, which is the miscellaneous provisions. Clause 31 deals with some capital expenditure requirements, and there's going to be an obligation that the franchisor must not require a franchisee to undertake significant capex in relation to a franchise business during the term. Again, I think this is really just a SOP to small business. You know, if you think of the way that IT is developing now and how important IT is to very successful franchise relationships in particular, the whole idea that you could not create obligations for your franchisees to maintain the currency of IT systems and things like that, which could be significant expenses, in my view, that's going a little bit too far. So I think it'll be interesting to see how this one plays out over time. Of course, the other side of that coin is that you don't want, you know, onerous requirements on the franchisees, particularly if they're struggling. Finally, in terms of these provisions, mediation, and the thing that I'll just draw to your attention is that the parties have to turn up, and this is a civil penalty provision. Having said that, there's no the reference to the actual obligations under mediation is really just to turn up. So I'm sure Mark will have some views on whether or not it's enough to just turn up to mediation, but I think the idea is that you should really try and do that, and you will have to do that in good faith, consistent with the overarching good faith obligation. As I understand it, there's going to be a detailed explanatory memorandum to accompany the code when it comes out. Okay, so in summary, some really good initiatives, but the problem really remains this asymmetry, which is just inherent in the relationship. The franchisor knows what they can bring to the table. All the franchisees want to be millionaires. That's just the reality of it. It's an asymmetric relationship. So it's about relational contracting, and that's the way that good franchisors do it, and in my experience, good practitioners facilitate that as well. So the pecuniary penalties for unlawful termination, I think that they're going to have an impact, but really in terms of the actual financial impact on franchisors, they're not going to be all that significant. I think the good faith provision is okay in the sense that it's sort of an overarching obligation, but it perhaps hasn't really been drawn as well as it might have been in terms of some of those specific provisions like mediation. I think it would have been better to actually have a particular requirement for good faith in mediation. And then you could actually at least have the argument, well, look, is this a frivolous dispute? So is the dispute itself brought in good faith as separate from whether or not people are actually attending and conducting mediations in good faith? The idea that you can't require your franchisees to pay the costs of mediation, I think it's pretty, you know, the more reputable franchisors generally, it's each bear their own in relation to mediation dispute resolution anyway, because they want to try and ensure that they're genuine disputes. Bad outcomes, I think the infringement notices provisions, I'm not sure if there's anyone here from the ACCC, but you know, the ACCC love a media release. The infringement notices are a very obvious way of the ACCC elevating the level of activity in this area. I'm not against that necessarily. There's some good and bad franchisors that need a bit of a clip. But the whole idea that the infringement notices is sort of a quasi-judicial sort of assessment of disputes, I think, is a bit of a risk. I think the short-form risk disclosure is just an absolute dolly in terms of broadening the scope for disputes and misleading and deceptive conduct. And I think there'll be a few transitional issues. In terms of its commercial impact, I guess overall, I think the costs to the franchisor of the relationship going forward are likely to be increased more than the costs to the franchisee. One thing finally that I'll just mention is if you actually look at the provisions of the Australian Competition Law in 51 capital A capital D, it's clear that the code is a regulation in relation to an industry, and so it applies under 51AE. But a contravention of the code is a contravention, arguably, of 51A, D. And so if you can establish that something is a franchise agreement, you'll be able to actually have all of the potential orders under Section 87. And part of the intention of these reforms is to actually provide for franchising or franchise-specific orders under Section 87. So in terms of disputes, there'll be plenty of crafty lawyers and much brighter lawyers than me who will be all of a sudden characterising licences and agencies and all of these other agreements as franchises in order to try and perhaps bring them within the ambit of the Australian competition law. Okay, just very, very quickly, just in terms of a little bit of background on the ACCC's role. This is from a speech which was given by Dr. Michael Shaper, the Deputy Chair. They received about 740 complaints and 114 inquiries involved in franchising last year. They go through a fairly elaborate triage process, and there's about 5 to 15 on their own data investigations out of all of those complaints. Now, I suspect, and I'm very confident of this, that in light of the changes to the regime going forward, there's going to be a lot more of those. Whether the ACCC has got the resources to investigate more than 5 to 15, I don't know whether that's really going to change. So I think the consequences are that the industry, the legal industry, will probably be called on to resolve more disputes, and I guess that's good for business for people in this area. But I think the other thing which is interesting is that if you look at how the ACCC might respond, then these infringement notices, I think, are going to be a real, they'll be a real factor going forward in franchising relationships. So I suspect that things will probably get worse before they get better. Okay, so more disputes are inevitable, and this is the segue to Mark. The reality is that litigation is rare in franchise disputes. Typically, neither party can afford a decent fight. That's just the reality of it. The franchisees are typically small businesses, although they can be relatively successful, you know, commercially. But if you look at the cost of litigation, typically neither party can afford a real fight. The things that sometimes do become real fights are often a bit, you know, ill-advised. In fact, there were some proceedings in relation to a franchise agreement earlier on this year where there was an absolute smoking gun which, you know, the solicitors or the lawyers or someone hadn't advised. In fact, I remember someone rang me up and they said, "Oh, what do you think of such and such?" I said, "Oh, I know which side I'd rather be on." But there was really evidence which meant that someone who was being prudent would have simply said to the client, "Don't litigate." But it went ahead. So that was really a situation where there just was a very big franchisor, and what had happened was they had a lot of money, they weren't too worried about the cost of litigation, and they'd backed a very small franchisee into a corner. And as anyone who's read The Art of War knows, if you back someone into a corner and they've got no choice, they will fight. There's only two types of people who do, people with money and people with none and no choice. So you do need to think about that. Okay, what does good faith mean? I think this is going to be the really sticky question going forward. And I think that it'll have a broader application and, as I've said, lead to more disputes. I think there's new and additional sources of tension as well. So I think we can look forward to interesting times. Just a couple of very quick, touch on a couple of very quick cases that you might want to have a bit of a look at. There's a very a recent... Now, I'm grateful to Mark for we were having a bit of a chat about this case, and Mark put me onto this one. This is a Victorian Court of Appeal case, and it talks about this idea that someone had actually gone to VCAT to challenge some conduct by a franchisor, and the question that arose was whether or not the arbitration clause in the franchise agreement, whether it sort of had, you know, whether it had had effect or whether or not, as typically if you look at the cases like Ahern, those sorts of clauses are often regarded to be ousters, and the court will actually just hear the dispute in any event. And it seems to me that it's probably worth reading if you're interested in just this question of how you apply arbitration clauses in agreement, because it's, I think, authority for the proposition that they will generally be given effect to and not regarded as ouster clauses. The other thing is it defines VCAT, or at least I think it's His Honour Justice Cairo's decision that regards VCAT as not being a Chapter 3 court, but there's other the other judgments say that it is. Now, that's an issue with respect to possibly franchising disputes going to VCAT, but the other thing is, as I've mentioned before, I think there's scope to bring them within the existing penalty, the existing provisions of, say, Section 87 applications for breaches of the ACL, and it's clear from the Australian Competition Law and Fair Trading Act in Victoria that VCAT has jurisdiction for those disputes in any event. So I think you can probably look forward to seeing some more disputation being resolved in VCAT, and that's likely because, of course, it's subject to the provisions of no-cost jurisdiction. The second case I just wanted to touch on is SPA licensing number 2. So that's 2014 Full Court Australian Federal Court at 50. It's a decision from the 1st of May this year, and it's a decision which is very interesting for a couple of reasons. It talks about representations as to future matters. Now, I think up until this point, the law's been a little bit mixed on whether or not as to the question is what are reasonable grounds for making a representation as to a future matter. And in this case, the court, in particular Justice Buchanan's decision, is very interesting. I think it's around page 15 or 16 where His Honour talks about the fact that the policy of the company at the time was to act in a certain way. That's the time when the representation was made, and so it was a representation as to a future matter at that time, and the policy being how it was at that time amounted to a reasonable basis. And it wasn't misleading or deceptive. It wasn't deemed to be by virtue of the future matters provisions. So it's worth reading for that reason. The other thing is that there's discussion at, if you have a look at around page 21, there's discussion by Justice Buchanan as to his understanding of the meaning of current disclosure. And also at page 31 to 33, Justice Farrell talks about the meaning of current disclosure. And I think that the view possibly was at the first instance that the decision in SPA licensing number 1 had expanded the view of disclosure. There was some language in there, for example, saying that if the particular provisions relating to disclosure in the code weren't read as an overarching sense of obligation, that'd be a bit too narrow a construction. But Justices Buchanan and Farrell, I think, really have a more conservative view actually as to what disclosure requirements are in the code. So I encourage you just to read those two cases. And then just finally, don't call Ghostbusters. You can call me, but all jokes aside, one of the things I think which is a tradition of Green's List is that, and most of you have dealt with the list will know, if you've got a question, ring Michael, ring one of the other clerks, or just ring any of the council on Green's List, and they'll be happy to help you. I think that's really, I guess, the bottom line. So who knows where the questions go. There you go. Handing over to Mark, in view of the fact that I reckon there's going to be a lot more disputation. Mark's mediated a number of matters that I've been involved in, and I certainly commend him to you as a mediator.